everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to The Kunstlercast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand novels. I am recovering right now from a pretty vicious bug that I came down with Thursday, so I apologize for the delay, although I did tell people a few weeks ago that we might have to take a break for the holidays, and I never got around to doing that, so forgive me. On today's show, Jim is going to be talking about the Republican nominees for the 2012 election. Before we begin, I want to be sure to wish you all a Happy New Year. And if you're anything like me, you probably received a few gift certificates to your local bookstore or maybe to Amazon. So I will ask that you please consider spending some of that gift certificate cash on the Kunstlercast book, which was recently released. The reviews so far have been good. There are some more on the way. And you can learn more about the book and read the reviews at kunstlercast.com/book. One other book I want to give a plug to is The Very Hungry City by Austin Troy, which just came out, released by Yale University Press. I do make a cameo in one of the chapters about transportation in small cities. Austin interviewed me a few years ago about my canoeing to work adventures, which you've all heard about. So that's in the book. I noticed that John Norquist from the Congress for the New Urbanism is in there, and there are a few other characters that you might recognize. So check it out if you want. The Very Hungry City, Austin Troy. Now here's Jim. Jim, good to see you.
Nice to be here on a cold, crisp morning.
Yes.
Very wintry out there, but no snow on the ground yet.
No, I know. It's actually probably colder and crisper inside my apartment than it is outside.
Well, that could be. Our teeth have been chattering between podcasts. But I drove down on Route 40.
Oh, yeah.
And largely because we do not have any public transit of any kind, so one must take a car.
But you're enjoying that drive, aren't you, the new drive?
It's actually very beautiful. It's really going through rolling countryside of upper Rensselaer County the whole way down, and it's quite beautiful.
Yeah, and there really isn't any suburban sprawl crap. There's a little bit, but...
No, you really get a sense of entering the edge of an old industrial city, you know, where the city just begins.
Yeah.
You know, there's a rural cemetery at the edge of North Troy,
yeah,
and then all of a sudden you're in the city, you know?
Yeah. Little update for listeners, I did attend your holiday party, and I did not slay a boar.
Oh. Oh, yes. I forgot to give you a gun to go do that, or a spear. I guess we were going to give you a spear and a loincloth.
I was going to.
I was too busy making meatloaf. Although I hasten to add, I am, you know, for all practical purposes, a vegetarian.
Yeah.
But, other, you know, you got to feed other people at a party.
Yeah.
Did you get loaded?
No.
Did you get a buzz on?
No. I was very responsible, Jim. I had one small glass of scotch, and that's it.
God, you're turning into a Methodist or something.
Well, I was driving, and you know, I don't want to hit a boar on the way home.
Yeah,
and
well,
have to explain myself to the police, you know.
You're a good lad, a good morally upright lad.
I try. Okay, so we are wrapping up 2011, and we're heading into 2012. There's a lot of chatter about what's going to happen.
Yeah, mostly, you know, people on the margins, you know, the people who are all involved in chemtrails and occult conspiracies and stuff like that.
Mm.
We don't subscribe to ideas like that in this podcast.
No, certainly not. And we will be checking back in with you to talk about your annual forecast. This year, we're going to actually wait till you've written it to talk to you about it. I usually ask you about it before you.
Yeah, before
it.
I don't have a thought in my head about, you know, before I've actually given any thought to it whatsoever.
Yeah, that's how we roll. Okay, but you do have some thoughts about what's going to happen on the political scene in the U.S. in 2012. And we've got the Republican primaries. We're heading into the Republican primaries. So what are your thoughts on that scene, the political scene?
Well, it's been a very interesting and rather appalling scene for the last several months, you know, watching all these clowns and grifters battling each other in the so-called debates. And, you know, they're hardly even debates. They're just kind of mass news conferences. Where these guys end up basically just telling different forms of lies and spinning different kinds of cockamamie stories, each in their own distinctive way.
And Jim, how closely do you follow this? Are you watching all these debates, or do you read them in the news after they've been caught?
No, I've actually watched quite a few of them. It's been an interesting spectacle to see, especially how, you know, the Republican Party has to sort itself out because, as far as we know, the Democratic Party has a presumed nominee, and that's the current president, Barack Obama. So it's really the Republicans who have to sort themselves out. And we of the field that's running, you know, a lot of them are still there. The only one who dropped out so far really was Herman Cain. Because he was subject to so many humiliating questions about his personal life. You know, although I must say, I am waiting for the one brave candidate to come along who will basically say a couple of things. One, that the sexual life of men with power can be complex. And that we are, after all, mammals who will, become involved in consensual sex. And I'd also like to hear a candidate basically just say, this has no relation to the political process, and I'm not going to talk about it. It's none of your goddamn business. And to really take a firm stand about it rather than equivocate or apologize, which, to my mind, is absolutely the worst thing that you can do. But Herman Cain didn't take that position. I didn't find Herman Cain particularly attractive, appealing in any way, even as somebody who's not a Republican. I mean, there was nothing about him that, as a political figure, that I thought had any weight at all. He was kind of just a sort of a salesman, you know, and had been a salesman for pizza, which is not a very, you know, complicated thing to involve yourself in your life's work.
Yeah.
I don't think he knew a darn thing about international politics, and probably would have been a very bad choice. But and you know, it's unclear to me whether he was getting a lot of support. I don't want to really drag this into the racial arena, but I part of me wondered whether he was simply the non-Obama. You know, he was going to be the other minority candidate, the other African-American candidate who was not Obama, and it's okay to vote for him. Anyway, he's gone. And so the remaining ones are Rick Santorum, a blank cartridge from Pennsylvania, former senator who was defeated in his last run to retain his Senate seat. He was thumpingly defeated. Rick Santorum, a very kind of troubling figure, an extreme conservative, and a kind of a monomaniac about abortion and sexual issues, and widely regarded to be a very dumb person, and when he was in the Senate, one of the stupider senators who was there. Why he persists in this quixotic run for president, I don't know, because no one is paying any attention to him whatsoever. His poll numbers are dismal. You know, even in these weirdly staged press conference / debates, the moderators never even call on him. He's just sort of standing up there like a cigar store Indian.
Jim, are you aware of Dan Savage's Google campaign against Rick Santorum?
No.
Where he got all of his, he's the sex advice columnist.
Oh, yeah.
He runs in all the alt weeklies. He did this thing called like a Google bomb, I guess, where you get enough people linking to some, when you type in Santorum, the first thing that comes up is this pretty raunchy, definition of what a Santorum is. I can't remember exactly what it is, but some kind of crude sexual thing. So it was pretty funny.
Is it like a Roman sanitary napkin or something?
It's something like that.
A Roman Tampax?
But at least Dan Savage has been paying attention to Santorum.
Well, good. We should have some fun with these people. You know, they should be objects of ridicule and abuse. And of course, people like to hear objurgations about public figures. Well, next up, of course, I think we're going in a kind of declension here from the least credible characters to the more credible guys.
Yeah.
The next in line is Michelle Bachmann, a loony from Minnesota, a congresswoman from Minnesota, coming from an extreme sort of religious fanatic, Christian cultist nut background. But, she does have some virtues as a politician. you know, some have called her an attractive female. And it's not out of the realm of possibility. You know, I mean, if we were on a desert island together, who knows? But, you know, it still might be hard. I'd have to put a paper bag over her whole body. Maybe put her in, I don't know, a plastic bag. Anyway, there's Michelle, who I think is stone crazy and subscribes to an agenda of religious ideas that I just think are dangerous, you know. Mainly, I think she, although she hasn't publicized it, I think she is aligned with the New Apostolic Reformation folks. They basically want to run everything from show business to politics to the media to all of our cultural institutions. You know, they want it all. And, you know, I regard them as the true cornpone Nazis and being very dangerous. Nevertheless, there's Michelle Bachmann, who in her professional life before politics, she was basically a forensic accountant and lawyer. I believe she worked for the IRS as an enforcer. And, you know, she does have some understanding of, you know, how money is gotten and spent by the government. She's generally regarded as a pretty good debater, pretty fast on her feet, and able to, you know, mount these combats with guys who are pretty heavyweight. The other night she mixed it up with Newt Gingrich over the question of his involvement with Freddie Mac, one of the government-supported enterprises that lost so much money in the subprime mortgage fiasco. And she, you know, she, we'll get to Newt in a moment, but she was able to counter his arguments and claims about what he was doing pretty deftly. But does she have a chance to be, you know, a presidential nominee? I doubt it. She may be hauled onto the ticket as a vice president simply to, in an attempt to get as many female voters as possible. And that's a distinct possibility. But I think she's a horse that ain't going to finish it for the top spot for sure. Next was Rick Perry. And by the way, all of these candidates have had their moments of efflorescence, you know, where they come along, they get the attention of the media and the people who the pollsters are talking to. And their poll numbers go up for a period of time, usually a month or so, and then they come down. And that has already happened with a lot of these guys. So next is Rick Perry, who was the comet that flew across the sky in the early fall. He came on board late summer. The governor of Texas, he's been governor now for, I think, at least three terms. So he's one of the longest serving governors that, you know, that around. But then again, Texas has a particularly weak governor job. He has very limited powers. And in many ways, he's kind of a figurehead in their political system. But so Rick Perry came on board. He's sort of like George Bush without the brains. Ha ha. You know, he's... he has the qualities of, you know, being a handsome middle-aged guy with a kind of, you know, Texas swagger that appeals to a lot of people and especially to the base of the party, which is, you know, largely Sunbelt based, you know, people who live in Texas and, you know, and Alabama and Carolina and Florida, et cetera. Mm. So, you know, he's appealing to them. But he made a number of terrible blunders and acquitted himself very poorly in debates. He was very slow on his feet and kind of embarrassed himself. And his poll numbers went down and he sank like a stone. He's still in there, but nobody is taking him seriously now. He just doesn't seem to have enough smarts to be in that job of president. So... we'll see what happens to him. He did attract a lot of money, and I imagine that he'll keep going just on the sheer momentum of his campaign treasure chest. But sooner or later, you know, he's going to drop out. Next, and the latest comet to fly across the sky, he's just reached his apogee about a week ago and may be in descent now, is Newt Gingrich. And Newt, of course, is a very interesting political figure in American history. He's already sort of an historical figure, and he'd be really quite an old president if he were elected. I believe he's 68 now, and I think Ronald Reagan was the oldest president ever inaugurated at 69.
Mm.
So he's getting a little long in the tooth. Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House in the 1990s. His term as Speaker was very abbreviated because he had such a wild hair up his ass, and he was so unreliable, and he kept on getting in trouble with the Republican members of the House that he was leading, because he would settle some kind of an issue in conference with them or in a caucus, and then he would and it would be what they had determined that would be their position. And then he would go out and say something completely counter to that, or do something, or make some move, as Speaker, some kind of legislative move counter to that. And he was driving them batshit. So they got rid of them relatively quickly after only a few years of being Speaker.
Yeah. Is he going to be branding himself as a maverick now for that? Isn't that?
Well, he hasn't so far. I mean, he's trying to drag himself as much as possible, into the broadest based mainstream position, in the sense that he covers everything and answers everybody, but in the party.
Yeah.
But the Republican Party is, when you really get down to it, such a narrow constituency, even in all of its parts, it's so narrow. All he has to do really is be, against abortion and wave the Jesus cross a little bit and show some military pugnacity and be in favor of drowning the government in a bathtub the way Grover Norquist wants them to do. Grover Norquist, by the way, an interesting and mysterious character who you may have heard about. He's been in the background of Republican Party politics for at least 20 years. And he's basically a sort of a political agitator and theorist who a lot of people listen to on the right wing. And Grover Norquist is famous for, during the Reagan period, for declaring that His aim in life was to shrink government to a small enough size that it could be drowned in a bathtub. So, his basic idea apparently is that there should be no government at all and no government services and responsibilities of any kind. So, Newt's trying to appeal to that constituency. And the thing about Newty is that he is a very smart guy, and he's very glib, and he does describe himself as an historian, and not only as a kind of a vocational idea, but even defending himself for his lobbying activities, he has pretended to have served not as a lobbyist for companies like Freddie Mac, but he claims to have served them as an historian. And I have no idea what he means by that. And I'm not sure anybody else does, because he basically got paid, millions of dollars to pimp for them in the halls of Congress. Mm. And to go around shaking hands and making deals. And that's what he did. He does have an interesting intellectual side to him that other candidates lack. And he's able to discuss a lot of things in depth that these guys can't. Now, whether he comes out on the dumb side of that finally, after he's gone through his song and dance, is another matter. But he's certainly capable of spinning a story and spinning a narrative and creating something for people to hang their own beliefs on. And he's also got some personality. He's a little prickly. He's a little bit, unreliable. You can never be sure exactly what he's going to do. You can't exactly pigeonhole him, even though, I would say that he's a right-wing Republican extremist. He's not exactly the kind of guy that you'd want to have a finger on the nuclear button. And he's shows a certain amount of belligerence in foreign affairs. He's eager to go and whack countries that behave badly. But in all fairness, I've said the same thing myself. In some cases, back after 9/11, I actually advocated turning some Islamic Republic into an ashtray. I wasn't sure which one it was going to be, but it seemed like one of them ought to maybe, go down that way. But so I'm a little extreme myself that way. Anyway, there's nudie. It seems to me that basically the people who run the Republican Party are going to gang up on him and try to get rid of him. But he's already gone through the arc of, the comet arc of popularity in the polls, and he's now descending as we wind down the preliminaries for the first big contest of the primary season, which will be the Iowa caucuses. They're not exactly primaries. Basically, you get a lot of people in a school room somewhere or an auditorium, who are sort of representatives of their community, and they voice their preferences for one candidate or another, and the outcome of that is a little bit kind of muddled and murky, but it has, because it's the first contest, people pay attention to it. So anyway, there's Newt Gingrich, a kind of an odious character, with some strange appeal just for being a wing nut. I don't think he's going to make it. I don't think he's going to be the nominee. But I do think that he makes the race more interesting because he has a way of getting the debates at least into more interesting areas, and he kind of deepens the discourse a little bit. Then there's Ron Paul. Ron Paul he's becoming like the Harold Stassen of the Republican Party. Maybe Harold Stassen was a Republican. Well, in any case, Harold Stassen was this character in the 1950s and 60s. Who had been the boy wonder governor of Minnesota, I think, in the late 1940s. But he ran for president practically every 4 years for the next 30 years until he became kind of a joke candidate, running on a joke third party. But Ron Paul is now the perennial Republican candidate, and he has a definite agenda. He is a kind of an extreme conservative of the old-fashioned fiscal kind, but he brings along some strange cultural baggage too, some of which I find incomprehensible, like the fact that Ron Paul is a physician. He's an obstetrician, I believe. He's famously bragged about delivering thousands of babies in his native Texas, the district in the state that he represents in Congress. Yet he's also a guy who apparently is a creationist. Yeah, doesn't believe in evolution. I don't really know how you reconcile those two things in your mind, to come out of a scientific vocation of being a doctor and yet not believing in, one of the primary scientific ideas of modernity.
It's interesting. I mean, you've mentioned this a couple times on the show, and we hear from Ron Paul fans, callers, and a couple events you were... someone asked you a question about Ron Paul. Why does it bug you so much? I mean, I believe in evolution. I'm not a creationist, and neither one of us are particularly religious. But why does it bother you so much, that a politician is a creationist?
I'm just allergic to religious nuts and religious craziness. And I just think that we need to keep that out of politics. It's important to keep it out of politics.
And you think that it's like a litmus test for you, this
evolution absolutely.
Question? Because I sometimes wonder, like, what the hell does the theory of evolution have to do with politics?
Well, I mean, because, I learned very early on when I was writing stories back in the 70s about the John Birch Society and other nut groups, because, I covered a lot of strange cults and political nut groups back in the day. I learned that when some of these ideas are present, usually they come with a whole train of other crazy ideas. So I'm very suspicious that, people who subscribe to, religious extremism are not also, extreme in many other ways. And, of course, Ron Paul is. He has a very extreme view, for example, of the role of government in medicine.
Yeah.
And I'm not persuaded that government will be able to remain in any way in the medical business or the medical administration business, simply because I think we're heading into such a financial calamity that that part is going to fall apart. Mm. But Ron Paul has been kind of notably cruel about his, you know, discussion about whether people should be allowed to live or die, or what, you know, whether we pull the plug on people who, you know, for one reason or another can't afford to be in a system. So yeah. He's regarded as being kind of cruel about it. And, you know, where Ron Paul is probably most appealing is in a couple of his views. One, that he's very much of an anti-war politician. Mm. He really thinks we should not be spending all this money in these exercises in futility in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, he wants to get out. And, you know, I think that that's a pretty, that's an idea that I would get behind. And he also has been very active in fighting against the things that the Federal Reserve has been doing for the last decade or so. And especially since the financial crisis of 2008, where the Federal Reserve has been acting like kind of a mad dog branch of federal policy without actually being a real government agency. Let's remember the Federal Reserve is really a consortium of private banks and banking interests, and a creature of the private banks and banking interests. And Ron Paul is really trying to tame it, discipline it, and possibly get rid of it. He's certainly been trying to audit the Fed to find out, for example, how much money they've been given away and how much, what they have in their vaults in the way of assets, liabilities, obligations, etc. We only found out about a month ago, as a result of a Freedom of Information Act suit by the Bloomberg News Service, that the Federal Reserve had in fact given out something on the order of $7.7 trillion to banks, as opposed to the presumed $700 or $800 billion that they were supposedly giving out under the TARP program. So, you know, the TARP program, which was a way of propping up the failing banking system in 2008, supposedly got this $700, $800 billion. But really, they were giving away trillions and trillions of dollars, and in many cases to foreign banks. You know, like the Royal Bank of Scotland got bailed out by American taxpayers. And you know, last time I checked, Scotland was not a state. So I think Ron Paul is rightly pointing out this stuff. Yeah. But he's a horse also that ain't going to finish. You know, he's actually pretty elderly. He would definitely be the oldest president ever elected. And, you know, I just don't. And he also has this sort of pinched personal demeanor of kind of like an Ebenezer Scrooge kind of look to him that when all is said and done, I don't think would go over too well with the voters. He looks like sort of your classic cartoon skinflint. And that sort of comports with many of his political ideas. So he would be regarded as a very cartoonish nominee.
And he doesn't have the presidential hair that people talk about.
He doesn't have that. Well, I don't know. A lot of people wonder whether he's serious about actually being president or if he's just in the race to keep some of his ideas, to inject his own positions and ideas into it so that they will be entertained, so that because the other guys aren't going to talk about these things. Mm. You know, one thing that none of these guys are willing to talk about is enforcing the law in financial matters. As much as somebody like Ron Paul, you know, talks about ending the Federal Reserve or disciplining it, mm-hmm. none of these guys have really clamored for the Department of Justice to prosecute the people who have brought about all these problems and run all these swindles and scams. Mm-hmm. But last but not least of all of these candidates, Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts. There's one guy I left out, and I'll bring him in at the end. First we'll get to Mitt Romney, who is a Mormon from Utah, the son of George Romney, who was a two-time presidential candidate back in the old Nixon Kennedy days. You know, back then it was hard enough for John Kennedy to be taken seriously because he was a Catholic.
Yeah.
But you know, George Romney, father of Mitt Romney, was a Mormon, and that was almost beyond the pale for American politics back then. He came out of the business world. He was the CEO of American Motors, which produced the Rambler, among other cars. I don't think it exists anymore. So his son, Mitt, was a Mormon missionary, you know, went to, I think he did his missionarying in Europe, though he got an easy assignment. And along in there somewhere, he worked for a company called Bain Capital, which was, I believe, a leveraged buyout company, which, you know, bought and sold companies that were in one way or another on the rocks and reorganized them and sort of picked them apart and fired a lot of people and then sold them off again, you know. And that's the way of, you know, the leveraged buyout industry. That's how they work. They're kind of predators. They're kind of the vultures out there picking the bones of corporations that are floundering. Then he became governor of Massachusetts and is best known during his terms for creating a health care law that more or less compelled everybody in Massachusetts to get health insurance one way or another so that everybody would be covered. And then he placed himself, when he decided to run for president, after that, you know, and especially after Barack Obama got elected, he found himself in the difficult position of having engineered a major health care reform in his own state and then having to denounce the one that Barack Obama was behind and signed as president. And especially the one element of it that was regarded as the crucial element, which was getting the uninsured covered one way or another. I don't know that either of these programs, the Massachusetts state medical program or the new Obamacare program, are necessarily successful reforms, or that they're going to save any money or make the medical fiasco any less urgent and desperate than it already is. But they both did the same thing, and now Mitt Romney is in the difficult position of having to defend what he did and pretend that he's against Obamacare. So I don't know how he's going to wiggle out of that one, but I think he probably will one way or another, because I think that when all is said and done, he may be the only candidate that will finally be acceptable to the voters in the Republican Party and the primary voters especially. He does bring this baggage of Mormonism along, and I personally do, you know, as a student of quack religions, I regard this one as being especially crazy. You know, Mormonism is really a very peculiar thing. You get this character named Joseph Smith, who comes from this large family of people who are, you know, moved from Vermont to Western New York in the early 1800s, and they're going around participating in this then fad called money digging, because there's an idea that there's buried Indian treasure all over this new land that's being opened up for settlement.
Which is kind of funny, because Indians around here used wampum for currency.
Yeah, right. I mean, if they had gold, why would they be using, you know, beads made from clamshells?
Right,
but,
right.
So, but in any case, money digging was this big activity, you know, on the frontier in the early 1800s. And farmers who were supposedly good at it or knew what they were doing, supposedly, would rent themselves out to dig holes on the newly settled land of their neighbors. And the Smith family did a lot of this. And there was kind of a competitive spirit in the family. A lot of brothers and the father was involved in this too. And among the youngest, if not the youngest, was Joseph Smith. And so, of course, you know, he sees all of his older brothers and his father going out doing this stuff. And he, you know, looking for attention, because being the runt of the litter doesn't get a whole lot of attention. You know, he comes back one day from a sojourn in the woods saying that he found golden tablets. You know, he sort of outdoes everything that all of his other family members claim to be doing. He also adds, of course, that he doesn't have the tablets, but, you know, he knows where they are and he can go look at them.
He can read them from behind a curtain.
Well, something like that. In any case, this cockamamie story gets elaborated over the years, and, you know, from the adolescence of this young man into his early manhood, you know, this cockamamie story attracts these followers, and it occurred during a period of great religious upheaval in America, a period called the Second Awakening, which was, by the way, kind of centered in upstate New York, in the area around Rochester, where many evangelicals emanated from. So anyway, he starts this religion. You know, he's a very charismatic person, Joseph Smith. He likes to party. At this point, drinking is not frowned upon by the organization. He likes the ladies, and he gets a lot of followers, and he moves westward. He goes first, I believe, to Ohio briefly, then further on to Illinois, where they establish a major settlement. Then there's some attempt to move on to Missouri, but in the process, Joseph Smith gets shot under hazy circumstances by a mob in Missouri, and is martyred, and becomes the great patron saint of the Mormon religion. The other elders at that point, including Brigham Young, pick up the standard of their fallen leader, and they quit the Midwest altogether and move all the way out to this kind of verdant valley in Utah, in the otherwise arid West. You know, there's this one valley which, because of the topography, gets a lot of rainfall and you can grow stuff. So they go out there to the edge of the Salt Lake, and they establish this colony, and there you have the Mormons. Anyway, Romney is one of the disciples of the Mormons, and I think it's kind of a crazy religion. You know, they believe in nutty things and cockamamie stories, but of course, almost all religions in one way or another are cockamamie stories. So, why pick on the Mormons just because they're newer?
Yeah.
But, and they have kind of an all-American brand. So I don't know, maybe it'll go over well with the public this time. You know, there are some things about Romney that, make him seem like he could be a credible candidate where the others couldn't be. You know, he has run a major state before as a chief executive, governor of a state. You know, he's run a business, even if the business has mostly been the predatory business of leveraged buyouts and corporate takeovers. He does seem to have some core of understanding reality, at least in a very general sense, that some of these other guys just don't have. And he may be the only guy finally who could be regarded as a dependable personality. But that said, I'm not even sure that he'd win in an election, and I'm not even sure what kind of condition that the major political parties are going to come out of this whole process in before the year 2012 really is halfway done. Because I personally believe that the nominating conventions in the summer are going to be very raucous and maybe even violent, that there's going to be so much disorder and trouble in this country in 2012, and so many angry people are going to descend on the Republican convention in Tampa and the Democratic convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, that it's going to be a real challenge to the party. There's also the possibility that some third party candidate could arise. In any case, I kind of think that Mitt Romney is going to be the fallback position if they don't go into a complete deadlock, which is probably unlikely. I left out one guy, John Huntsman, also a Mormon, by the way, and a guy who was appointed ambassador to China by Barack Obama. Mm. and in some ways, much more of a level-headed guy than even George Romney, and not as extreme, not as right-wing, you know, much more of a centrist character and kind of an appealing character. But he really hasn't been able to make an impression on the rank and file, and his poll numbers are poor. And, you know, personally, I don't think he's going to make it, but he's hanging in there. His father, who is extremely wealthy, has started a political action committee in order to funnel money to his son to enhance his chances of at least being able to sort of stick it through the first round of primaries, especially, you know, going into the New Hampshire primary after the Iowa caucuses. New Hampshire used to be the first primary, but that's all been sort of rearranged over the last several presidential elections. The states have all been jockeying to try to be the earliest first one. Mm. And, you know, they just keep on shoving the date further and further and further and further back. And New Hampshire is still early, but it's not the first. And after that comes Super Tuesday, where you get the Carolinas and Florida and some other states all at the same time. And a lot of delegate votes are then sort of captured. And so that's a big day. We'll see who's standing after that. You know, finally, there's another outsider in the pack. Just today, Sarah Palin kind of let it be known through whatever channels she has access to that maybe it's not out of the question for her to change her mind and run again.
I don't think that's going to work, do you?
Yeah. Well, you know, they say a woman always has a right to change her mind.
I think people are tired of her. Let's talk third party politics real quick, though. I mean, the first presidential election that I voted in was 2000 when Nader was. Is that the best that any third party candidate has done in a while?
Nader's a little bit too old, and you know, I don't think that he's going to be coming out of the woodwork again. But I think other guys could.
But was that the best? No, there was also. You know, Ross Perot was
a third party
candidate too.
Well, he's not coming back.
No, but I'm just saying, is that the best showing of third party candidate? That's the best showing of third party candidates in my voting career, but it's not very long, obviously.
Well, there was George Wallace back in 1972. Of course, he was also gunned down, by Arthur Bremer during the campaign. Did he run in 68 too? I don't even remember. But anyway, he actually did attract quite a following. And there was John Anderson in the 80s, a congressman from the Midwest who, you know, was sort of an alternative.
And how well did they do though? Because like Nader didn't even get 3% of the vote, right?
Well, the one who really made a difference was Ross Perot.
Yeah.
Because he really took a substantial, not a plurality, but a substantial minority of the vote, so that I don't think that Bill Clinton won by a majority. I think he won by a plurality of the popular vote.
Yeah, that's when people, they claim that third-party candidates just take votes away from, you know, the two major parties, which I think is just a bullshit attitude to have. You're never going to have a viable third party if you treat them like that.
Well, third parties, we haven't had that many transitions of the basic established parties in America. There was that kind of jockeying for position that went on in the first, 30, 40 years of the United States, where, you start out with the Federalists, who are kind of the conservatives of the time, and as opposed to Jefferson's Democratic Republican faction, you know, which then becomes basically the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and eventually sort of mutates into the party of Andrew Jackson, which is the beginning of the modern Democratic Party, at least in the sense that it was the party of the common man rather than the privileged moneyed class. But then, after Jackson, the Democratic Party kind of morphed again into the party that supported slavery. And, the conservative party of of that day ended up being the Whigs. That's W-H-I-G. They had a run of sort of being in charge of things for about 20, 30 years. And then they disappeared in the 1850s out of sheer irrelevance. And they were sort of replaced by another third party, the Republican Party. And that the Republican-Democratic nexus has been with us ever since.
Yeah.
There have been a few intermezzos where you had, with Roosevelt, you know, the progressive Bull Moose Party coming in 1912, after Teddy Roosevelt had served one and almost two terms, but his first term was when he was vice president and assumed office after William McKinley was assassinated at the World's Fair in Buffalo. But that was pretty early in his term, and so Roosevelt served out most of McKinley's term and then got a second one. But the Republicans got kind of sick of him. At that time, there was no restriction on the number of times you could run for president, but they nominated William Howard Taft in 1908, and Roosevelt was left on the sidelines. Taft served as president for one term, and then Woodrow Wilson got elected as a Democrat in 1912. And he was a two-term president, although he was disabled by a stroke for part of his second term. Teddy Roosevelt ran for president again in, I believe it was 1912, in the race with Taft and Wilson. And I think he had a pretty good showing with the Bull Moose Party. But, you know, it was his party, and when Teddy Roosevelt died around 1920, that was the end of, you know, a separate progressive party. In point of fact, the Democratic Party ended up evolving into the Progressive Party with Franklin Roosevelt, really with Alfred Smith. Alfred Smith, who was the governor of New York and was a Roman Catholic, the first Roman Catholic ever nominated by a major party to run for president, was defeated by Hoover. But he was also taking the Democratic Party back into being, you know, the party of the common man against the plutocrats of Wall Street. The crash didn't occur until after that election. Smith was defeated in the election of 1928, and the Wall Street crash occurred in 1929. And Hoover served during the first really 3-4 years of the Depression, and by then the Depression was so well established that, you know, the lines were really pretty set now for Roosevelt to take stage and become the great political progressive and champion of the common man for, you know, for the next 40 years. The Democratic Party kind of assumed that position.
Yeah, so it sounds
now the two parties are kind of indistinguishable. They're both really the parties of the established, entrenched, plutocratic interests, and you know, I think it's time to get rid of both of them.
Well, you say get rid of them, but then listening to just the history that you're describing, I mean, you can either have a party become totally irrelevant, and then a third party comes and takes its place. It seems like we always end up with two, though, at the end of the day, the way things sort of. Or you can just totally shift the focus of the party. We all know the Republican Party today does not resemble, you know, the original Republican Party.
So and it's certainly not even much like the Republican Party of Dwight Eisenhower and Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah, and the Democratic Party doesn't resemble.
Yeah, it's not the party of the working guy and the unions. It's really only been kind of pretending to be while it's been sort of screwing them and supporting the plutocracy. So, yeah, no, I agree with you that either these parties can change and mutate and morph into something new or die. Now, I don't see any real chance that the Democratic Party is going to be able to salvage itself, at least this time around. You know, given the promises that Mr. Obama represented and his incredible thumping failure to live up to them, I just don't. And if he's going to be the figurehead again, I don't really see how he can repudiate himself and his own legacy and run against himself at the same time that he's running against whoever the Republican nominee might be. But both parties are in danger of dying of irrelevance, and a lot of it will hinge on how they respond to the possible challenges and disorders of angry protesters who descend upon them this summer. You know, if they bring out the police and start thumping people on the head and gassing them and pepper spraying them and shoving a lot of people in jail, you know, which I think they're both capable of doing.
Yeah.
You know, I think both parties are going to suffer a huge loss of credibility. And if by then another third party candidate emerges, and I don't know who, I mean, frankly, I actually... Maybe it's poverty of imagination. I cannot think of any other people right now except Michael Bloomberg and Howard Dean. I just don't know who else it might be. But it's also very possible that neither of them will step up to the plate. So, you know, we'll see where this takes us.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts on the political scene. We'll have to keep an eye on it. And I will see you next year.
Yeah. I look forward to it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.